This is What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by Andrew Holland, ASP's Director of Studies and Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Maggie.
So we're going to talk a little bit about climate security. Obviously, you run our climate security program, so you're the perfect person to have this interview with. For people who aren't so familiar, can you give us a quick primer on what climate security is?
So the impacts of climate change on security are kind of broad and also specific. So by broad, what I mean by that is that climate change affects literally everything that that we do, that we think about. It affects our economy. It affects where we live, how we eat, all of this sort of stuff. But then when we talk about specifics, we get down to what the Department of Defense and what our national security institutions think about climate change. So how our national security institutions think about climate change is how it's going to affect areas of operations around the world and how it's going to affect how they do their jobs. So how conflict could start because of climate change. The terms you hear a lot are what we call accelerant of instability or threat multiplier. This language appears in DOD's formal 2014 Quadrennial Defense Review. This is something that they're thinking about and have been looking at.
So what is it that the DOD is doing about climate change, and how does that impact a climate security plan?
So ASP has been working on climate security since 2009, and it's to look at how climate change is impacting national security and then what we're doing about this. I have an article out in June 2016, Scientific American, that talks about what the military specifically is doing about this. And this is important because this isn't just some rhetorical turn of phrase. This isn't about climate change is a threat to security and therefore you should pass a carbon tax or a cap and trade or something like that.
Right.
Of course, that's important. But it's also about planning for the actual changes in climate that are happening right now and are projected to be happening. We've baked in a good
right.
bit into the system. So the military is actually working on this. And there's two ways to think about it. One is kind of what's a changing climate going to do to our bases and stations around the world? So you think naval bases at sea level, think training ranges in the desert, how these things will change. And in a lot of ways, that one's kind of easy to do. It's a simple risk assessment. Sea level is going to rise X feet, and you have to do X amount of land. You have to raise the piers
right.
X feet plus a little bit. So it kind of it's an easy thing. It doesn't mean it's cost free,
right?
But it's if that then this.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is a little bit more difficult, and this is how climate change will affect operations around the world.
Right.
This requires a little more critical thinking. And it's not simple linear equations. It's
right.
not. It's not as simple as climate change causes war. You
right.
can never say climate change causes this specific war or anything like that. But you can say that climate change impacts things like drought and extreme weather, which then impact migration. Drops in human security, which then impact instability
right.
and conflict. So it's kind of this chain of causation is what I call it in the article. And it's always difficult to tease out which causes what, but that doesn't mean it's not happening. So in the article, I kind of look at three areas where the military is beginning to do things on it, and call it the three A's: Africa, Asia, and the Arctic.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So before we get into those three A's, just to think about maybe a specific example, and not to say that climate security isn't a threat, but it also presents some opportunities. I'm thinking specifically about the Marine Corps' involvement in the Philippines after Typhoon Haiyan. So that is a place where our diplomatic relations have struggled, and as a result of the Marines coming in and providing some much-needed assistance, that's sort of changed our geopolitical relationship. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so this is kind of at the core of, especially in the rebalance to Asia and how climate change impacts that. So especially throughout the Asia-Pacific region, we're seeing an increase in the severity of typhoons, more super typhoons than we used to see. And when coupled with rising seas, you have increased vulnerability. The Philippines is no stranger to typhoons. It's been hit. It's right in the track for typhoons. It's hit every year. But that doesn't mean they're prepared for a typhoon that is beyond all scale and past typhoons. So in November 2013, Typhoon Haiyan hit Tacloban, Philippines, with sustained winds of 195 miles an hour. The maximum height above sea level, which includes storm surge and tidal surge, was something like 47 feet.
Wow.
A huge thing. In response, then Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel immediately ordered the USS George Washington's battle group to the Philippines to get on station. And you say the Marines, 13,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines.
Right.
To be clear, all arrived. And what's interesting is this: so 7,000 people died in Haiyan, more than most deadly in the Philippines in a long, long time. But what's interesting too was that there was kind of this decline into lawlessness that was beginning to happen. You saw reports of what you call the New People's Army, an armed wing of the Communist Party in the Philippines, was attacking government convoys. There was riots over food supplies, where
just general distress
everything was falling apart.
Yeah.
You know, it's this decline into lawlessness and
This like instability that you're talking about, that climate change and climate change fueled storms can really bring.
Right, and so then the once the USS George Washington battle group arrived, you didn't see these things anymore. So it was about, yes, delivering aid and support, but it was also about kind of stemming this decline into lawlessness, because they were able to get to places that were unaffected. So, you know, this is also about diplomacy too, because of course the Philippines cares about the impact that climate change is having
on
it. And if scientists will, argue about how much any one storm has an effect on climate change, but the fact is that the Filipino government understands or sees extreme weather like Haiyan as a threat to security and as something that's harmed them already. So, you know, it was within 6 months of that Typhoon Haiyan that the Philippines signed an enhanced defense cooperation agreement with the United States. Now, that's also a lot about South China Sea and Chinese aggression and all of this sort of stuff. But I think it doesn't help, but it doesn't hurt to be reminded that the U.S. military is on your side when a storm hits.
Sure. And looking at these three areas that you outlined in Scientific American is where are sort of the next theaters of climate change, terror, or war, you know, Africa, the Arctic, and Asia. First, my initial question is, how do we pay for this? Who's responsible for doing things like, you know, providing aid and assistance after a typhoon? It's not something that we traditionally think about as the responsibility of our military, but we've been doing it for ages.
So we have been doing it for ages, but for a long time, it was not a defined mission by the Department of Defense. It was something that the military did because they were in the area and because they could do it, but they didn't train for it and they didn't equip for it. It's only within the last couple of years that DOD has upgraded what they call HADR, Humanitarian Assistance and Disaster Response, to a defined mission. Right. So that means they plan for it, they equip it. And if you ask the leadership of PACOM, they'll say that this is the one mission they do the most of.
Right.
They expect every carrier battle group that deploys into the Pacific expects to have at least one major disaster response. Now, partially that's because the Pacific is the so-called ring of fire, so you have volcanoes and earthquakes, which obviously are not climate change related,
right.
But you also do have increased, like we said, extreme weather and storm surges and rising seas. So it's something that is happening. Now, who pays for it? There's $100 million every year, I think, in the DOD's Overseas Humanitarian Disaster and Civic Aid Program, but that money is declining.
Yeah.
A lot of the, you know, it doesn't necessarily, though, get its own budget line item.
Right.
So it's a part of operations, and it's not insignificant.
So now that this humanitarian aid and disaster relief kind of category is its own mission, how do you think that impacts how the military approaches the Arctic, Asia, and Africa, the African continent, going forward?
Yeah, so Africa is especially interesting because unlike Asia and the Pacific, it's a light footprint for U.S. military forces. There's not huge carrier battle groups deployed around the coast. There's only one active American military base on the continent in Djibouti. And so most of what U.S. military does in Africa is through partner organizations and partner militaries. It's about training and equipping these forces. It's about working with these countries. So it's more of a light footprint. And so that's more what it is more about kind of risk analysis and assessment. Mm-hmm. You know, thinking through how climate change, for example, in Africa, Lake Chad on the border between Chad and Nigeria and Cameroon. It's about 90% smaller today than it was only 20 years ago. And that's partly to do with desertification of the region, but it's also partly to do with population growth and poor irrigation practices. So it's but it certainly has to do with climate change.
Right.
What's happened in that region was as farmers and fishermen lost their ability to make a living, a number moved, but a lot that were stuck got caught up in Boko Haram and an uprising against the Nigerian government. This is kind of this example of an accelerant of instability.
Right.
You take an already unstable region and it makes it worse. So the trick is for AFRICOM is of course AFRICOM and is fighting Boko Haram and trying to stem its growth. But in terms of climate conflict, the trick is to figure out where that next area of instability is and stop it before it gets as bad as Boko Haram.
Right.
So
so it's backtracking from Boko Haram and thinking, okay, how do we work on irrigation practices? How do we work with governments to provide, you know, additional when needed grain supplies to keep a lid on food prices, that kind of thing.
It's adaptation, and it's also, frankly, it's about increasing the ability of the government to work together,
right,
to actually work,
to function, you know, at all.
To function at all, because, you know, a big it's these areas where the government doesn't work and doesn't come together at all.
Right.
So there's you can't really call it a climate conflict, but it certainly has to do with there is resource scarcity. And so in Burundi right now, is an interesting example. The president has come to the end of his two terms and wants to stay on,
right,
against the Constitution. Now, you can't call this a climate conflict.
Right. You would say basically it's an issue of rule of law, but...
Right. But the underlying drivers are there. You know, there's been stress on agriculture.
Right.
There's been a lot of other things. Now, what's happened is that, you know, there was an attempt in coup d'etat.
Mm-hmm.
Roughly 500 people were killed last year and displaced 250,000 more. But this is actually kind of a success story, because as morbid as that sounds, it was only that damage. It wasn't a full-scale civil war yet.
Right.
Because the military refused to get involved.
Right.
And the military refused to get involved mostly because they're actually fairly well-trained and professional, and they've worked a lot with the United States AFRICOM forces,
right,
so which helped make them well-trained and professional.
Right.
So this
and,
is...
And gives a very different legacy of some former AFRICOM commanders than we're used to thinking about.
Right. So it's kind of stopping a conflict before it starts. So, you know, that is important and different.
So our last question is the same to everyone who comes on What's Next, though we may frame it a little differently this time. Keeping in mind this Arctic, Asia, Africa kind of framework, if the United States is successful at, you know, better integrating climate change into threat analysis, and not just analysis, but mitigation, adaptation, and strategic planning, what does that mean 20 years from now? And if we're not successful 20 years from now, what does it mean too?
Yeah, so 20 years is a good time horizon, because that is kind of your planning horizon,
right,
for the military. And so if we're not successful, I think you'll see throughout Asia, low-lying regions become more unstable. Sources of emigration into bigger cities and across borders, which can be destabilizing. You know, I think you'd see throughout Africa and then the borders between the developing world and the developed world kind of more, frankly, walls and moats going up, stopping migration and kind of a lot more dangerous thinking about this sort of stuff. Now, if we are successful, I think what you'll be able to do is, we're not going to stop climate change in 20 years. Climate change is...
We're a little late on that.
Yeah, we are. And you know, a lot of the stuff we're doing, Paris was not about the next 20 years.
Right.
It was about the 50 years after that.
Right.
It's about, you know, we're going to see rising seas. We're going to see increased storms. We already are. But, you know, the Paris Agreement and things like this are about preventing, you know, huge areas of Africa from becoming uninhabitable, preventing,
right,
you know, huge areas of South Asia and entire island chains in the Pacific from going underwater, things
right,
like that. But we have to be a little bit, you know, if we're successful in kind of integrating climate change into this, we're going to have to be more ready to respond to extreme weather. And we're pretty good at that already. the trick is to have a bit more foresight into this kind of climate conflict right. nexus, and to see where the hot spots, call them, will be in the coming years, and then actually, you know, we can have foresight, but then actually do something about it too.
Right.
You know, actually send
recognize the information.
Yeah, exactly. To actually send aid, send military, force, and all these sorts of things before the actual crisis. You know, it's always going to be cheaper to have prevention rather than response. So.
Well, loads to talk about. Andrew Holland, Director of Studies and Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate here at ASP. We will most certainly have you back. I know tons of people are dying to hear you talk about Cuba. So stay tuned for that. This has been What's Next from ASP. Thanks.